Woo! While the heathen way jungle people imagine vain things, the kings of the herd stood up and the rulers were gathered together against his lord and against his saints. I say, man, you got to know yourself.
It is Sunday morning at 9:30, and welcome to another International Connection. You're listening to 88.1 CKLN. We've been in the middle of an extended series on mind control here on the International Connection. This is week number 11, and we have heard so far, if you haven't been listening the last few months, a lecture by Dr. Colin Ross and an interview with Colin Ross about the U.S. government, CIA and military's use in creating Manchurian candidates by using multiple personality disorder. And we also heard testimony given at the radiation hearings of survivors of this. And we also heard the story of Ronald Howard Cohen, a writer and activist that was abducted and drugged by CIA and military. We're hearing this week part two of a lecture given by Dr. Alan Shefflin. And this is entitled The History of Mind Control, What We Can Prove and What We Can't. And this was given back in 95 in Dallas, Texas at a conference. And we're going to listen to part two today.
It's not my function here to criticize the intelligence agencies or to condemn what they have done. I'm instead trying to argue the point that the hypnosis community in general, and psychologists and psychiatrists as well, need to know the data that was produced and which still exists in CIA files if we are going to be accused by the false memory people of using undue suggestion to get people to do things they wouldn't otherwise do. We need to know the limits of those possibilities. And that material is in CIA files. Therapists are being sued across the country. They need access to that information to help defend themselves. And so it is in the spirit of science and in the spirit of protecting therapists and patients, for the good of the country, that I present this material so that we can hope that the full amount of it is ultimately revealed. I also must make a caveat. I can only report on information that I've seen either through my search of CIA files and my interviews with CIA hypnotists and other hypnotists. There may be mistakes in what I present. I cannot correct that unless I have access to all of the material. And so if I have made a mistake, it is a mistake that comes from not being given the material, because I have in good faith worked through the material I have to tell as accurate a story as I know how. The CIA began experimenting as soon as it was born in the late 1940s. The experimentation in mind and behavior control had already begun in the OSS with hypnosis experiments, truth serums, truth tablets, and lethal pills, as well as other kinds of experiments. But it was after the Cardinal Mindszenty episode that the CIA began to really become concerned about the possibility of hypnotic coercion. And let me quote to you from a CIA document at the time. This is a February 10th, 1951 CIA top secret memo called Defense Against Soviet Medical Interrogation and Espionage Techniques. Quote, hypnotism has been reported to have been used in some cases by the Soviets as an adjunct to interrogation. It would be possible for a skilled Soviet operator to lower a prisoner's resistance to questioning and yet leave him with no specific recollections of having been interrogated. With respect to inducing specific action on the part of a subject by hypnotism, it would be possible to brief a prisoner or other individual, subsequently dispatch him on a mission, and successfully debrief him on his return without his recollection of the whole proceeding. A June 1951 CIA memo says, quote, CIA interest is in the specific subject of devising scientific methods for controlling the minds of individuals, unquote. And so by in the late 1940s, some essentially uncontrolled experimentation was begun by various people within the CIA, and a more structured program was also undertaken, which had the name Bluebird, and that name was then changed to Artichoke. And under Projects Bluebird and Artichoke, the attempt was made to bring together all known knowledge of interrogation techniques, truth serums, polygraphs, and hypnosis to create essentially an elite interrogation team with facility in all of those endeavors and have them do the work that would be needed, first of all, to protect against infiltration by enemy agents, and also to protect the minds of American agents who might get captured by communist individuals. In the early 1950s, Walter Smith, the director of Central Intelligence, in an eyes-only memo, issued an order that he wanted an answer to the question, quote, whether effective practical techniques exist whereby an individual can be caused to become subservient to an imposed control and subsequently that individual be unaware of the event, unquote. And so the purpose of the CIA experiments by the early 1950s was to discover the ways to control the minds of individuals. And Bluebird and Artichoke were one part of it. There were other parts as well. The CIA's facility in Langley did not exist at that time. They used office buildings throughout the Washington area and safe houses in around the country and throughout the world. In 1953, we get a new program from the CIA, which is the most expansive mind control program in the history of the world. Its genesis begins in 1953 with a speech given by Alan Dulles, who was the new CIA director. In his speech, Dulles said that we were losing control of the battle of the mind, that we were at war with the Soviet Union. He called it brain warfare, and the Soviets possess knowledge which the United States did not. A memo 2 months later, in June 1953, a top secret memo states, quote, interrogations of the individuals who had come out of North Korea across the Soviet Union to freedom recently had apparently experienced a blank period or a period of disorientation while passing through a special zone in Manchuria. By 1953, in other words, that the notion of the Manchurian candidate, almost in those exact terms, had been theorized by the CIA. I'll come back to that point in a moment. But in Dulles's public speech in April 10th, 1953, to Princeton alumni in Hot Springs, West Virginia, he argued that we had to do something to make sure we did not lose the war with the Soviet Union. About a week and a half later, he signed into law what was called MK Ultra, all capital letters. Walter has speculated, and I think it's a good speculation, that the MK stands for mind control, and Ultra was the code name given to breaking the Japanese and German codes, and so this was the code name given to breaking the code of the human mind. MK Ultra was 149 sub-projects. It was the umbrella for 149 sub-projects, all of them under the auspices of Sidney Gottlieb and later directed by his boss, Richard Helms. The 149 sub-projects, you can read something about this in government documents. This is a project, MK Ultra, from a joint hearing of, I think it's the United States Senate. And so the material, some of the material, has been made public by the Congress. Other material has not been made public. But the existence of MK Ultra, you know, is not a secret, and its contours are known to some extent. The purpose, another government document, also explores some of the same territory on bio. This one is on biomedical. Research, biomedical and behavioral research by the government. The goal of all 149 sub-projects was mind and behavior control. Some of them involve botanical, some of them involve things like psychosurgery and electrical stimulation of the brain. 9 of the sub-projects involved hypnosis. Some of the sub-projects involve things like voodoo. One of them involves circumcision to create anxiety and then manipulate the anxiety. Almost anything you could think of and things you wouldn't think of as ways to control the mind were funded and studied. Maybe one of the more well-known studies and one of the most notorious now is the work that was done by Ewan Cameron in Canada. Cameron was the president of the Canadian Psychiatric Association, the American Psychiatric Association, and the World Psychiatric Association. And in his work in the 60s at the Allen Memorial Institute in Montreal, he had a theory that sounds unique but actually exists in Brave New World Revisited, and even goes back to the ancient Greeks. His notion was that you could completely erase a personality by regressing an individual back to an infantile state, a process he called depatterning, and then you could program that individual with a new personality, a process he called psychic driving. In order to destroy the original personality, Cameron put his subjects to sleep for up to 2 months, injected them with LSD, mescaline, and other psychoactive chemicals, and essentially engaged in a form of regression therapy. Age regression may be a hypnotic phenomena, but this was, in a sense, an actual regression. This was the attempt to manipulate people back to a state of infantilism. When was this? These were the 1960s. Yeah. These were people who came to him because they were depressed, or because they were, in other words, this was the local psychiatric institute, and you went there if you needed help. Let me continue, because I've got a lot more to cover. I'll take questions after. One of the people who came to him, I don't have a slide of her, but I've done some TV shows with her, was the wife of a member of the Canadian Parliament. Val Olerkoff was her name. She's dead now. And Val had just had a baby, and she was suffering, I think, from postpartum depression. Listless, didn't feel she was able to care for her baby or for herself. And in general, she was feeling unequal to the task of wifehood and motherhood. And her husband suggested that maybe she could benefit from some psychiatric care. And she thought that that was a good idea. And they made the mistake of winding up going to Ewan Cameron. And Cameron destroyed her life. And she, along with, I think, 10 or 11 other people, ultimately sued the Canadian government and the Central Intelligence Agency. The CIA contributed funding to Ewan Cameron's experiments. There was 60 Minutes did a story on this that I show at meetings from time to time. One of the people went there because he was feeling badly, and he went through the same kind of process, and they later discovered that he had a minor skin disease, and a single shot of cortisone would have cured him. But his life was ruined, and as he put it, he said, where do I go for help? I don't trust any psychiatrist or psychologist or therapist anymore after what they did for me, and I know I need their help, and yet I've been programmed to not trust them. And so where do I go for relief? The experiments have been written about in detail in a number of books. This is the least reliable, Gordon Thomas's Journey into Madness. Harder to find, a Canadian book, I Swear by Apollo, is more accurate. Perhaps the best of the books is Ann Collins' In the Sleep Room. And in some ways the most compelling and the most, I wouldn't want to say important, but the one most emotional perhaps is Harvey Weinstein's book. This is the Canadian edition, A Father, a Son, and the CIA. And it's slightly revised and it printed by the American Psychiatric Press here. As, can you lower that to the... It's so that we can see the title. Is there somebody? No. Okay. I don't have the title here. It's something like Psychiatry and the CIA. Okay. Harvey's father was one of those people who was depressed and went into the Allen Memorial Institute and as a human being and came out as a vegetable. He never did become a whole human being again, and indeed it was what happened to his father that led Harvey into psychiatry. And Harvey's conclusion is something that should be read, I think, by everybody in the mental health field. After all of the knowledge of the CIA experiments and the Army experiments and Air Force and Navy experiments have come out, after all of what we know, not a single researcher has been subjected to a single lawsuit or even censure by a professional organization for work that was clearly illegal and clearly unethical at the time. And the message must be, if there are no consequences to doing these kinds of work, the work will continue. And indeed, you know, that's certainly most likely what has happened. And so Harvey's conclusion is that if the professional organizations are not going to step up and condemn this kind of experimentation, then it will be repeated and other generations will suffer the horror that his family suffered. Now, Cameron's experiment was simply a part of the series of brainwashing tests to regress people back to this infantile state. Now, the Greeks had Greek sleep temples that had a similar focus, but modern technology added to Cameron's work. He used a tape loop. He would interview an individual. You've heard about Erickson's power words and whatever. He would find words that were important to his patients, and he would program those words in messages that he would construct on tape loops that would be played into their brain a half to a million times to a million and a half times. And so, in fact, these people were quite literally programmed. In a state of infantilism, Cameron wrote that they could endure sensory deprivation indefinitely. Whereas most people would crack by about 8 hours, these people could stay there indefinitely. The psychic driving in which the tape loops were used was the attempt to reconstruct a personality. And I wondered where such a fiendish idea would have come from. And I found it in a 1951 science fiction novel called The Demolished Man, by Alfred Bester. And if you are a science fiction buff, I certainly urge you to find that book and read it. Basically, the theory of the novel is that when somebody commits a crime, that shows a certain boldness that society should appreciate, but it's in the wrong direction. And so what they do is they take criminals to the hospital and they regress them back to infantilism, and then they rebuild a new personality. Exactly the idea that Cameron was working on with his subjects had been written about a few years before he began as a science fiction novel. I won't ever know whether he had read that novel because Cameron is dead now, but the studies from his work showed that it did not work, and indeed it caused a great deal of pain to a great number of people. Okay, let's move on because time is moving on. The idea of manipulating people with hypnosis in ways that are effective and in ways that are quite bizarre it was born in the brain of George Estabrook, seen here. Estabrook's very interesting character was working in Morton Prince's laboratories at Harvard in the 1920s, and he had the idea that if you could cure a multiple personality with hypnosis, maybe you could create one with hypnosis. Well, why in the world would anybody want to create a multiple personality? Well, Estabrooks had the solution. You could create then a super spy, or indeed a super assassin, somebody who would do the bidding his country, and have no knowledge that he was engaged in those acts. Estabrooks said in 1928 that my views are here somewhat different from most psychologists. I believe the hypnotist's power to be unlimited, or rather to be limited only by his intelligence and his scruples. And so in the 1920s, he went around trying to convince the military to create hypnotically programmed individuals, create a multiple personality, and use that one as a courier. They thought he was crazy and ignored him until the Moscow show trials. And then they took him seriously. And in the archives of his work at Colgate, there's a notation that he stopped publishing in the mid-1930s, because his work had then become classified. If you read his book, this is the Morton Prince's Dissociation of a Personality, the classic work, beginning works on multiple personality. If you read Estabrooks's book, Hypnotism, through its various editions, what you discover is that each edition is more assertive about the validity of creating hypnotically programmed couriers. And finally, in an interview he gave in a local Rhode Island newspaper in 1963, he claims that this is not science fiction, it is fact, I have done it. Working for the FBI and the CIA, that he would create a multiple personality, program that personality to be a courier, send that personality somewhere in the world, and then have them return and have them be amnesic for all of that. Now, the idea may have originated with Estabrooks, but he may not have been the first to actually publish it as such. Writing in the Psychoanalytic Review of 1947, Major Harry Levitt of the U.S. Army Medical Corps described the hypnotic creation of a secondary personality. Quote, hypnotically induced automatic writing was established early in the course of treatment as a means of expeditiously gaining access to unconscious material. After this procedure was utilized for a time, a hypnotic secondary personality was produced by suggesting that the writing was under the control of a certain part of his personality unaware to him. Levitt then said that he created another personality in direct contrast to the one already established, so he could work the two created personalities off against one another. He concluded, again, quote, regardless of whether the production of multiple personalities by means of hypnosis could be construed as additional proof that hypnosis is an artificially induced hysteria, or whether the multiple personalities were artificial entities resulting from direct suggestions, there exists a close relationship to personalities spontaneously arising in hysterical dissociation. The importance of producing multiple personalities experimentally lies in the fact that certain elements of the original personality may be isolated, which manifest a minimum of censorship influences and thus may serve as helpful adjuncts in hypnoanalysis. Well, that was not the purpose for the intelligence agencies in working with the idea of creating a multiple personality. The story of the intelligence agencies creating multiple personalities to use as couriers and assassins may have begun with Esther Brooks, and indeed in CIA documents, I think this is, you can see Esther Brooks's theories worked out and discussed. But the genesis of the work begins in 1951 in the CIA Office of Security, where an official named Morse Allen got the idea that CIA agents should be trained in hypnosis, and in order to train them in hypnosis, he arranged for them to go up to New York and get training from a stage hypnotist. As soon as he and the agents got to New York, the stage hypnotist spent an hour and a half with them, regaling them with tales of hypnotic seduction, of how when the hypnotist went on the road, he would sleep with a different woman each night. Some of them he would give hypnotic hallucinations that he was their husband. Others he'd use other techniques, but that this was a technique that he found very productive for his own sexual favors. The CIA, of course, was delighted to hear all of this and reported so in the documents. If you could use the technique to manipulate people that way, this is what they wanted to learn, and so that's how they got trained. Then in from 2,000 to 3,000 pages of documentation going from 1951 to 1954, the Morse Allen and his group replicated all of the known hypnosis experiments involving people putting their hands in acid or in jars of snakes and in shooting people, daggers, all of those experiments that the French and Germans and American researchers had conducted. Esther Brooks and Esther Brooks and others had conducted. Morse Allen and his group replicated. But they wanted to go further and explore the possibility of using hypnosis to create a programmed courier and a programmed assassin. Now, the multiple personality idea itself may have come from Jekyll and Hyde, which was very popular at the time, another illustration of that idea, in which two entirely different people can live within the same body, one being the embodiment of good, the other the embodiment of evil. It was good fiction, but it also was part of the genesis for Morton Prince's work, an Italian depiction of multiple personality. It's cut off at the top, but you can see the two faces pointing in other directions. By the 1950s, the popular press was reporting in the Three Faces of Eve the existence of multiple personality. The three faces, of course, were more than three faces, and the final face was not the final face. I'm Eve was Chris Sizemore finally telling the story with her real name, and then telling it again, a mind of my own. Well, her mind may be her own, but her life isn't. She's now suing the film company, which claims that did the movie The Three Faces of Eve. They claim they own the story of her life. She claims they own it only up to the time that she had three faces and that the other faces still belong to her. So she's still not in control of her identity, and the fight goes on. Here she is in person. Sybil was then the next known, you know, or highly reported case of multiple personality disorder. Herb Spiegel tells me that Sybil was not a multiple, and that when he treated her in Cornelia Wilbur's absence, that Sybil never had any need to express any other personalities with Herb. Herb admits she was brilliant and also extremely mentally ill, but that she was not a multiple and that he refused to participate in the writing or publishing of the book if that was the spin they were going to take on her case. On the other hand, Herb doesn't believe, he believes that multiples exist, but that the condition is extraordinarily rare. And so people have argued that she was smart enough to know he wouldn't believe it, and therefore smart enough to conceal the personalities from him. So the debate goes on.